next guest is Nachum Kaplan, an ex-Aussie who has started up a site titled Moral Clarity, Truths in Politics and Culture, in an effort to counter the misinformation and disinformation being delivered to us by the mischievous purveyors of propaganda. I'd like to welcome Nachum Kaplan to the Israel Connection. Nachum holds a degree in politics from Monash University in his native Australia and has spent 30 years working as a journalist, commentator, and C-suite media strategist to Fortune 500 companies. For those listeners who are not aware what a C-suite media strategist is, it's basically somebody who appeals to the high-powered bosses of such companies in particular. He's held senior editorial positions and helped set the strategic direction in some of the world's leading newsrooms, including Reuters and International Financing Review. Nachum has worked in Australia, Indonesia, the UK, Singapore, and travelled extensively for his work. Good morning to you, Nachum, from Singapore.
Good morning, David. Thank you for having me on.
See, I was pleasantly surprised to hear your accent when I first contacted you. You're an old Aussie. Then do you come back to Australia every now and again?
Not as often as I would like to. I still have family in Melbourne, and I still kind of consider Melbourne home, if you like. But I don't get a chance to come back as much as I would like to. I've just been just so busy, really.
We welcome you back in a virtual sense now as we talk. We know that understanding the world is harder than ever. There is too much information, too much propaganda, and too much virtue signaling. This is what you say on your website, Moral Clarity, Truths in Politics and Culture, which is your vehicle to speak truth to nonsense. Can you tell us a bit about your endeavor that invites readers to get an experienced, professional, and critical take on key global developments related to politics, culture, and media?
Well, Moral Clarity was really born from October the 7th. I've kind of been kicking the idea around of doing something along this for a little while. And then when October 7th happened, which was obviously I was as shocked as everybody else was by the events that day. But what shocked me even more was the response to it, even before Israel had regained control of its territory, even before Israel had fired a retaliatory shot. There were protests in streets from London, from Sydney, Toronto, New York, Paris, Kuala Lumpur, you name it. They were out there and they were just chanting wildly, rabidly anti-Semitic bile, quite frankly. Nothing was done to stop these people. We literally had the surreal situation in which we were watching the police keeping the streets safe for the jihadists and the Nazis. So that really bothered me. And then what bothered me even more was to see the media pick up on that same narrative. Even before there was an actual body count on how many people Hamas had killed, even before that, there was pleas for it to be seen in context for what had happened. Nothing happens in isolation in the Middle East. It has to be seen in context. And all this kind of apologetics came into it. And it just struck me that, my goodness, nobody seems to know right from wrong anymore. And perhaps we're in some kind of a moral crisis. As I watched the media come in more and more, I started looking at it through a media lens, you know, as a career journalist and a media strategist. It just became, you know, so clear what was happening. All the tricks of the trade were being used. And this is not coverage of an event. This is an orchestrated campaign. It's very well organized. It's very well thought out. It is extremely skillful. And I just wanted to make people aware of that. So I launched Moral Clarity. And when I launched it, I was a little bit concerned that maybe there's not an appetite for long form journalism anymore. Maybe, you know, I should be doing something on TikTok. But I didn't do that because, you know, it's, you reach people when you do it that way, but you also dumb it down when you do it that way. But much to my surprise, you know, it's had a huge response and now have readers in 45 countries. And just, you know, consistently I get emails from people saying things like, I'm a Roman Catholic and I care about the truth. So it's not just a Jewish audience that has latched on to this. And I think that's because, A, I'm writing a little more widely than Israel, although I'm writing extensively on it. But the response to Israel really is the perfect case study of what is going on in our society and our culture more widely. So that was the origins of it. And it's just kind of gone from strength to strength.
So you weren't writing in this kind of a vein before October the 7th. This really brought you out of your shell, so to speak.
Yeah, that's correct. I've been a journalist for 30 years. I've mainly been a financial journalist, an economics journalist, writing about all those kinds of things. Obviously, economics and finance connect very directly with politics. You cannot write about finance and economics without looking at politics. They're not things that can be separated. It's just I've taken my lens that was on the financial and moved it to the political.
Well, your efforts are certainly most welcome, Nahum, I would say. Given your experience in some of the world's leading newsrooms, what can you say about attitudes that you've come across concerning Israel in your own experience?
In my own experience, it's very much been a case of they know what the Israel story is before any particular event happens. So there is a whole lot of premises around the Israel-Palestinian conflict. And a good example would be the West Bank is occupied. Now, there's certainly a political consensus that the West Bank is occupied. That's certainly the case. Then they go on, it's illegally occupied. And that's an entirely different question and a much more complicated question because it's not entirely clear at all that it is illegally occupied. But the whole discussion around that does not exist. It is an article of faith that the West Bank is occupied. And every story is written from that premise. And that's already set up partisan coverage, because as soon as you've said that, you've got one side in the wrong. Now, once you've got one side in the wrong from the start, you no longer have objective journalism anymore, because you're working on a premise that one side is the aggressor or one side is the wrong party. And there are other examples of it. The idea that Gaza is an open air prison, would be another one. None of these people have stepped foot in Gaza, yet are making pronouncements of what life is like there. And it's just an article of faith that is going on. There is an article of faith that the Palestinians are fighting for a state. And no doubt some of them are. But groups like Hamas are not fighting for a state. They are an Islamist caliphate-seeking organization, and they make no bones about it. And even that just gets pushed down. The reporting starts from the premise that Israel's running a prison in Gaza. Israel's occupied the West Bank, and it's fighting an opponent that wants a state that it will not let it have. All of those things are incorrect. And from a journalistic point of view, it should be reported and pointed out. It's a pretty deep fundamental problem, because in newsrooms, no one is asking the questions or making the point that I have just made, or very, very few anyhow.
Well, this has really been a perennial problem. It's not suddenly emerged following October 7th, but it's been concentrated now and emphasised.
Yes, I think that's right. You're absolutely right. It is a perennial problem. What's happened, I think, is October 7th has brought it into sharp relief, and it's also revealed the scale of it. I think the scale of it is much worse than certainly I realised.
Hmm. So this is your reaction to the media in general about the ongoing war in Gaza. Those particular points you've just mentioned, we'll go into this in a bit more detail by referring to what you've written. Being Australian, do you take any special interest in the way the Australian media is operating in this Israel-Gaza war?
The Australian media has, by and large, fallen for all the same tropes and problems that media elsewhere has. I mean, particular media. I mean, SBS in Australia, for example, is actually using coverage from Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera is a mouthpiece of the Qatari government. It is set up for that purpose. Al Jazeera reporters in Gaza have been active Hamas fighters and terrorists. This has been documented. When Israel shoots those terrorists, it gets reported as Israel is targeting journalists. It is just kind of surreal. But on the ABC in particular, on SBS in particular, we have seen a lot of this. The Guardian, of course, in Australia, the Australian version I'm talking about, not the UK version, although their Middle East coverage is substantially similar. I guess the only real pushback in Australia has been from Sky.
Yeah, from Sky and the Australian newspaper.
And the Australian, yeah, good point. Yeah.
But they're all under the same umbrella of news media. That's where that all comes from, stems from.
Yeah, correct, correct.
Your article that you wrote, I think we're going back now to just a few days ago, this one, Stopping the News Media Rot. This is
something you wrote.
So this pertains to what we're talking about. So what have you said there that can elaborate on what we've been talking about?
As I alluded to earlier, the coverage of the Israel-Palestinian conflict really is a microcosm of what's happening more broadly in our media. And I think media standards have started to decline in the last 20 years or so. There are lots of great journalists out there still. There is no doubt about that. And there is lots of great pieces of journalism being done. There's no doubt about that either. But I'm not so sure there are any great institutions of journalism left. You know, the days when you say, the New York Times is one of the great journalistic institutions of the world. I don't think there's any paper that we can say that about credibly anymore without somebody laughing at us or rolling their eyes. It's hard to pinpoint exactly where that happened, but I think it's really useful to have a bigger sweep of it all and look at it pre-internet, post-internet. The internet brought all sorts of confluences onto newsrooms. But the first thing it did was disrupt their business model. Now, it disrupted their business models because business model was essentially, we sell newspapers at a nominal price to get a mass subscription. And then we take that mass audience, present it to advertisers to advertise against. And that's where the real money is made. And that had served the industry for the better part of 100 years very, very well. Then the internet comes along and advertisers realize, we can advertise to our audience directly via the internet. We don't need to go through an intermediary like the media to do that anymore. So it just becomes more effective because you can target your audience, and it becomes more economic because there's not a middleman, i.e. the newspaper, taking a cut. Newspapers take an economic hit, and their response to that is to shrink their newsrooms. And they're shrinking the newsroom because they just don't have the funds to sustain a large newsroom anymore. So it's kind of the first hit to media quality. And the technology did something different as well. It disintermediated the flow of information. Now, I can remember as a young reporter going down to the finance ministry, and you would wait for the government to announce the inflation numbers. The government would announce the inflation numbers, and the journalists would scramble to write that first. And it would be the journalists who were distributing that information. What happens now is the finance ministry will just post that number onto its website. So the journalists were always redundant in that flow of information. Once this happened, newspapers started to think, oh, wow, we don't have a role to play here anymore. The response to that was a fewfold. But the main response was that we have to change what we write so that people will be willing to pay for it, because getting people to pay is essential because we don't have advertising revenue anymore. And we have to write something that people cannot get themselves from something like the government just releasing information on the website. So the answer to this was what newsrooms call move up the value chain, which is, it's McKinsey kind of speak, isn't it? This kind of idea that it's not enough to report news anymore. You have to tell people why it's important and what's going to happen next. Now, this is the point where news started to move more and more into being analysis and fortune telling. This is what's going to happen next. This is going to be a disaster. And it turns out that journalists aren't very good analysts because they're just different skill sets, right? And nobody's good at predicting the future. Like Yogi Berra said, right? I try to avoid predictions, especially about the future. So newspapers were pushed into that. And the part of newspapers that once were clearly marked, opinion and editorial, and that would be a small part of the newspaper in the middle, this kind of writing now occupies all of a newspaper. Automatically, newspapers are not news. They're now kind of analysis. Now, because they need people to buy this to make their money without advertising, they have to write what people want. And this phenomenon in media circles is known as audience capture. So you get captured by your audience. You write, for example, a right-wing view of the world. You attract right-wing readers and subscribers and viewers. And then you have to present that because that's where you're making your money now. And if you don't present that, then, you risk upsetting them and losing them. And this is just a race to the extreme in terms of media coverage. So there has always been, you know, right-leaning and left-leaning media. But now the left is over here and the right is over here. They're at extremes now. And that, to some extent, represents the broader political divide in Western cultures at the moment. But it's not just a reflection of it. It's a contributor to it. It's really dangerous in a democracy where we don't have an agreed set of facts or an agreed narrative. Now, we can disagree on the margins of the narrative, or we can disagree precisely how the dots should be connected together. But that's not what we have at the moment. What we have is newspapers that are living in parallel universes.
There's also great competition from commentators like yourself, who operate independently of the main news media, and they're providing commentary, which in many cases is superior to what newspapers are providing.
Yeah, that's a good point. So people like myself and have really moved in to fill what they perceive are the gaps left in the media by this polarization. So people are looking at it and they're saying, well, let's provide a perspective that actually is not a crazy perspective. Once would have been a fairly mainstream perspective, but now because everything's become polarized, that view is not being heard at all. So people have started moving into that. And because people like myself writing these things don't have any audience capture, we can write what we want and how we honestly see it without sort of having some commercial boat that we have to upend.
Yes, well, I'm kind of in the same game too, in a sense, Nahum.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yes. So I came across your initiative, Moral Clarity, Truths in Politics and Culture, by way of an essay you wrote that was published on Joshua Hoffman's site, Future of Jewish. And a few weeks ago, I interviewed Joshua and have been following his posts. I'm referring to the piece titled The Stunning Dystopian Strategy Behind Hamas's Media Machine. Hamas has had great success controlling the West's narratives about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, despite most of it being outright lies, as you have said in your piece. How have they achieved this? Do you want to go through the reasons that they are succeeding in what they're doing?
Yeah, certainly. It's really interesting to watch, because I think one of the things that doesn't get talked about enough when we talk about Hamas is how capable and intelligent these people are, that they are in the thrall to some terrible ideas. But you think of this underground network of tunnels, for example, that they had built in Gaza. If that energy had been driven or put into building a state, one can only imagine how good life in Gaza might have been. And that same kind of skill has been, and intelligence has been brought into their media approach. So they've recognized, you know, lots of things really. One of the great things they've done is actually, when I say great, I mean great from a PR point of view. I don't mean great from a moral point of view. One of the effective things they've done is they've co-opted other people to be their spokespeople. They have co-opted the United Nations and many of its officials to talk for it. They have got media around the world acting as its mouthpiece. They have got politicians and even world leaders in parliaments around the world talking for it. And obviously these voices have greater credibility than Hamas talking about it themselves. It's a really interesting question as to how did they do this? How did they do it? And they did it with some old-fashioned sociological analysis. The first thing they identified was that anti-Semitism in the West is only ever dormant. It's never asleep. So they didn't have to build a whole new narrative. All they had to do was wake the sleeping monster, and then they would have a natural ally. And the primary way they did this was basically taking old anti-Semitic blood libel tropes in particular and updating them. So the old blood libel tropes become Israel is committing genocide, Israel is engaged in ethnic cleansing, you know, Israel is murdering babies as part of that. And most recent version of the updated blood libel is that they are starving Gazans.
Yes.
But, you know, all this is just, they've just updated the blood libel. And because anti-Semitism was there, just dormant, all they needed to do was wake it. And they did that very, very successfully. And then they had a natural ally, with people with whom they agree on absolutely nothing else. And the next thing they did was recognize that they had a numerical advantage in two ways. Now, it is too simplistic to say that, you know, all Muslims support the Palestinian side and all Jews support, or Jews and evangelical Christians or whatever support the Israel side. There's more nuance to it than that. Nevertheless, it is largely true. Now, there's over 1 billion Muslims in the world, and there are 16 million Jews in the world, or whatever that the number happens to be. Now, in the world of social media, where basically that is a virtual army waiting to be activated, it's going to be almost impossible for the Jewish narrative or the Israeli narrative to stand up to that. It's just overwhelming array of numbers. And they knew this. And they kind of exploited two particular biases that is often used in media. They exploited what's called the repetition bias and the immediacy bias. I don't know if I mentioned the immediacy bias in my piece, actually. So the repetition bias is just a psychological shortcut in which when we see something over and over again, we think it is more likely to be true than something that we've only just heard or something we've not heard very many times. They know, but just by repeating and repeating and repeating and repeating and repeating, doesn't matter if it's true, doesn't matter if it's not, our brains are almost wired to see this as, oh yeah, this is true. I'm reading it everywhere. It's got to be true. And the second one is the immediacy bias, in which we think things that happen now are much more important than things that happened in the past. On October 7th, that was the most important thing in the world. Now, as soon as Hamas had been successful in shifting the narrative to look at the terrible things being done to Palestinians in Israel's response, because that is happening now, and October 7th happened in the past, that feels like it's the most important part of the story when it's not necessarily the case. So they've exploited these two biases very systematically and very cleverly.
Actually, before you go on with the next point, as far as this numerical advantage is concerned, Nahum, they actually claim the high moral ground because they say they have the numbers. If there's more numbers supporting their side, well, their side must be right.
Yes, indeed. It's an absurd piece of reasoning, of course, and the Earth would still be round. If 90% of humans thought it was flat, it would still be round. So there isn't a voting floor or a democracy on facts or truth. But, you know, nevertheless, you know, we are a group species. We like to fit into those around us. This kind of argument does resonate with people, even though in their more rational moment, they know that it's not. The other sort of numerical advantage they exploited was just the number of Muslim states that there are. And this is really a key one. Because there are 40-odd Muslim states in the world, this has enabled them to get power in all sorts of multilateral institutions, from the United Nations itself to, you know, World Health Organization, to any number of multilateral institutions that you can think of. And what this does is it gives them credible people, or people with credible titles more accurately, because some of them are not actually credible at all. That there is a real credibility when someone turns up and says, you know, I'm the head of, you know, let me make one up. I'm the head of the World Food Aid Program at the United Nations, and I say there's starvation in Gaza. Now, the fact that someone with such a title, with such an institution behind them is saying that gives it real kind of authority. And because there are so many Muslim states and they have managed to get credible heads in so many positions, it really does sound like there is universal condemnation of it. Well, it's not. It's just a political body that they've managed to hijack.
So you've commented further in your article about controlling the information flow as being another strategy.
Yes, controlling the information flow is, of course, is a key one. And they've done this in a couple of ways. They've done this both in Gaza and both in the West Bank. In the case of Gaza, Israel's contributed this to some degree, to be honest, because the IDF has not allowed foreign media full access to Gaza. Now, Hamas has recognized this, which means they've basically produced an army of stringer journalists, if you like, and photographers who are feeding news that cannot be verified from Gaza. sending photographs that cannot be verified from Gaza. So they've got a complete monopoly on the information coming out of Gaza because nobody else can get in. So they've exploited that very, very cleverly. On the West Bank part, they've just used more traditional authoritarian tactics. It has been the case for a long time that if you want to have access to the Palestinian territories and access to report from there, you cannot be too critical of the Palestinian Authority or you will be thrown out, you will be targeted, your family will be targeted. And there are many Palestinian journalists who have tried to write about the corruption of the Palestinian Authority who have been subject to this. You know, for international correspondents, if they do not have access, they cannot justify being there, spending their nights at nice hotels in Tel Aviv. They have to toe the line as well. They've managed to control it through force and through restriction of access and threats of losing restriction of access. So they've got large amount of control of the information flow coming out of those regions.
So I recommend this particular article, and I'll share it with my listeners so they can go into it in greater depth than we have time to do right now. In the same vein, Nachum, you've written a couple more articles recently, namely The Great Moral Inversion and War of the Words, Israel, Hamas and Truth, which appeared late last year. So clearly this issue of media manipulation is of major concern to you. Is there a way out of this situation where Israel faces the brunt of mass media that is largely critical and often antagonistic toward Israel?
Oh, I wish I could answer that question definitively, but I'm most certainly not equipped to do so.
Positively, at least.
There's certainly, and you know, this is a piece that I'm currently working on. Israel can play a much better PR hand than they have done so far. There's no doubt about it. Hamas have played the perfect PR hand. Israel has had a hand-fisted go at it, and there's a whole variety of reasons for that. You know, to do with the nature of Israel being a democracy and having a free press, to do with the fact that it's a divided society, to do with the fact that its cabinet is a mismatch of people from across the political spectrum, who has, you know, quite extremist people talking, and then what they're talking about gets perceived overseas as government policy when it's not. So there's all sorts of things that they could do differently to find a better PR game. Is that enough to overcome the numerical and the structural disadvantages that they face? I don't think so. No, I think the best thing Israel can do is fight a better PR war, but actually win the actual war. Win it quickly, win it decisively. Then the PR war doesn't matter so much because there isn't anything going on to tell lies about.
Now, the United States and several Western countries, including Australia, unfortunately, have spent recent weeks exerting huge pressure on Israel, demanding that it not enter Rafah in the Gaza Strip, all under the pretext that a military offensive would cause heavy civilian casualties amongst the local population there. Now, who exactly are these leaders preaching to? Why is there no real pressure being brought to bear on Hamas, who were the perpetrators of all this in the very first case, to agree to a ceasefire and then offer the unconditional release of the hostages, which has been demanded by the United Nations Security Council, but there's no ability to put any pressure on that side. They're just words that come out that can't be channeled into a meaningful result.
Yeah, this is really worrying. It strikes me that the answer to this is pretty grim. It is, a large chunk of it is old-fashioned anti-Semitism. There has been anti-Semitism against Jews pretty much for 1,500 years in one form or another. It takes different forms on the right and the left, and it takes different forms in the Christian world and the Muslim world. So it takes kind of different forms, but it's always been there. And now we find ourselves, well, we don't like Jews. Now half of the world's Jews are in that one place. Let's start attacking that one place. That's essentially what it is. I know that people will not like to hear that. They will jump up and down and they will say, oh, you know, we're not anti-Jewish, we're not anti-Semitic, we're just pro-peace. I call it apologetics because it is apologetics. But the question I always have to these people is, why do you get animated only when Israel and Jews are involved? You don't get animated what's happening next door in Syria, what's happening in Yemen, what's happening in Sudan, what's happening in Russia and Ukraine, what's happening with the Rohingya in Myanmar. no shortage of conflicts around the world to get animated about. Many of them are much bigger and bloodier and with higher death toll than this particular conflict. The reason they obsessed with this one is because there were Jews involved.
So you're saying this has seeped right into the higher echelons of our society. You put this criticism right on the shoulders of our major political leaders around the world, that they're guilty of this.
Yes, they're absolutely guilty of this. And not just of what they say, but the political cultures they have developed and fermented. You know, anti-Semitism takes forms from the right and the left, as I alluded to. And that presently, it's coming pretty hard from the left. And this has essentially been a case of the left have this view of the world, the progressive left at the moment, that everything is some kind of battle between oppressors and oppressed. And everything must be looked at through this framework. Problem here is that Israel's success and Jews' success more broadly upsets this framework. Under this worldview of, you know, oppressor versus oppressed, it's a case of, oh, you've been oppressed throughout history, you know, therefore you are disadvantaged in society today, therefore you are suffering, you know, intergenerational trauma from past racism and things like that. And Israel comes along out of the Holocaust, out of the mass expulsions from other countries, and voila, they built a thriving, prosperous, democratic state within a human lifetime. Now, if everyone is supposed to be a victim, held back by their past, this should not be possible. So the left looked at this, and instead of saying, oh, our paradigm is wrong, we may need to tweak it, they simply moved Jews and moved Israel from the oppressed column over to the oppressor column to make sense of the world. And that's what's driving a lot of this, this stuff from political leaders, is that worldview.
Well, I've really enjoyed speaking with you, Nahum. We're very much on the same page. And I think my listeners will certainly appreciate what you're doing. And I recommend them to go to your site to catch what you're writing. How would they do that?
So it's a Substack site. It's called Moral Clarity, Truths in Politics and Culture. So if you just go to Substack and type that in, it will come up. Some of the stuff is behind a paywall, but the majority of it is freely available. All the new stuff is definitely freely available. It's mainly archival stuff that's behind the paywall. But if you do want to pay for it to support, no, I won't say no.
Well, I thank you again, Nahum. Great job you're doing, and we appreciate it, I must say.
Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate that too.
You've just been listening to an interview with a former Aussie, Nahum Kaplan, who has created the site Moral Clarity, Truths in Politics and Culture, in order to redress the lies and misinformation being disseminated every day.